You are listening to Based in Fact, a true crime podcast. Join host Lisa O'Brien and Kyle Evans as they examine America's most infamous true crime cases as they were established in our courts and the basis for the decisions of the appeals courts, not the court of public opinion. Here's Lisa and Kyle.
Welcome to season 3 of Based in Fact, a true crime podcast. I'm your host, Lisa O'Brien, and I'm joined today by the charming, wonderful, and talented Roberta Glass of the Roberta Glass True Crime Report, who has graciously agreed to sit in for Kyle, who's taking care of some work obligations today. This is episode 4, State of Oklahoma versus Scott Eisenberg. In January of 2023, Eisenberg was executed for the 2003 murder of A.J. Cantrell in Depew, Oklahoma. We'll talk about the facts of the case, his trial, direct appeal, and post-conviction proceedings, and arguments by Eisenberg and his advocates that Mr. Cantrell was responsible for his wife's death and that Eisenberg was acting in self-defense when he killed Mr. Cantrell. And welcome, Roberta. Thank you again for sitting in for Kyle today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And happy St. Patrick's Day, because we're recording on St. Patrick's Day.
Yes. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
So, I wore orange to work on Friday, but nobody got it.
Oh, boy.
But it had green
That's
in
a good
it.
Thing.
So I was hedging my bets. And then I'm going to wear green tomorrow.
Excellent. Excellent. Excellent.
So
where do we start with this low life?
Well,
low life sociopath.
As you've probably heard when you listen to this show, we start with the victims. And Mr. Okay. Eisenberg has quite a few. There are some who even were very lucky to escape their encounters with him with their lives. Their first victim is A.J. Cantrell. He was born January 28, 1927, in Depew Creek County, Oklahoma. He was a sign painter and also a talented musician. He married Patsy Mae Melton around 1950. They had three children, daughters Deborah, Marcia, and Linda Gay, who died in 2005. His injuries were multiple blunt force injuries to his head. Victim number two was Patsy Mae Melton Cantrell. She was born March 10th, 1933, with her twin sister Peggy Faye in Depew Creek County, Oklahoma. Her parents were Leslie Powell Ted Melton, who died in 1966, and Ora Eunice Reed Melton, who died in 2008. Her older brother, Leslie Powell Melton Jr., was born in 1929. He died in 2022 in January. Her twin sister, Peggy Faye Green, died in July of 2022. She married A.J. Cantrell around 1950. Now, unfortunately, the Cantrells were in their 70s, so even though there was some social media and internet at the time of the crime, they don't have an electronic footprint that really could provide much information about them, which is really sad. There is, however, in the biography, in the obituary for her sister, there's a much more information about Peggy, but not about Patsy. Again, she had daughters Deborah, Marcia, and Linda Gay, and she died from a shotgun wound in the back.
Awful.
The next victim was Tyler Montgomery. He was 16 years old. His mother was Kathy Wright Biggs. The Wright family lived across the street from the Cantrells in Depew. He had multiple gunshot wounds by shotgun to his back. but he survived. It was a very long recovery for him, but he did survive. The next victim was Carla Wright. She was Tyler's grandmother. Her husband was John Wright. Her daughter, Kathy Wright Biggs, who was a former girlfriend of Eisenberg. And she had blunt force injuries to her head, but she too survived. And then finally, the last two victims were Dr. Samuel Warmoth Peebles, who was 70 years old, or over 70 years old. His wife, Martha Suzanne Peebles, they encountered Eisenberg and were kidnapped by him in Arkansas and driven to Texas. And they each had blunt force injuries after their encounter with Eisenberg, but they did survive. All right, the perpetrator, Scott James Eisenberg. He was born January 10th, 1961 in Detroit, Michigan. His father was Stanley A. Eisenberg, who died in 1998. His mother was Devonia. No information about her anywhere on the internet. She died in 1961 by suicide. And then he had a stepmother named Dorothy Eisenberg, who died in 1976 when he was 15, 16. He had a sister, Kimberly. Yes.
I just thought that was really interesting. We'll get to it, but just it seems like he has a real, maybe a hatred, fear of any of women, you know. And I guess if you were going to be some kind of psychologist about it, you'd go back to his mother committing suicide and his stepmother dying. And, you know, that comes back in the clemency package. You know, we'll get to that. But, you know, I just found that very interesting.
I think he was a sociopath. So the only person that mattered was him. He was had equal hatred for men because his father abused him. And his father was, you know, resentful of him.
Right. And we always talk about these psychos or sociopaths or psychopaths or antisocial personalities, whatever word you want to use for it, being beat up or mistreated as a youth. But there's lots of people who are mistreated as youths that don't go on to do these things and actually end up contributing to society and rising above it. You know, there seems to be some kind of new mindset that you can't ever overcome anything. And just having it happen to you gives you free license to behave any way you want to for the rest of your life, no matter how damaging and destructive.
Definitely. That's apparently, because he repeated everything he says about his father. He was the same man, except that he went further and went beyond terrorizing his own family members to terrorizing people who actually tried to make him part of their community and help him and care about him. But we'll get into that a little later.
Talk about no good deed goes unpunished. I mean, that's
exactly.
Sadly. Yeah,
exactly. In fact, thank you very much, because I did not have my little, you know, I have the little saying after the case title, and no good deed goes unpunished is perfect for this case.
It's my father's, one of my father's favorite sayings. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's really sad that these good people really end up being victimized by this horror.
Yeah. Man. So back to Eisenberg, he dropped out around 10th grade, began working, although his employment history is very mysterious, to put it kindly. He married a girl named Donna, who he'd been dating since 1982 and fathered a child with in 1984. They divorced about 1986. And then in 1992, he married a woman named Roberta, And right around 1992, they divorced in 2002. He had three children: Jennifer, born in 1983, Alan, born around 1993, and Emily, born around 1997. He worked as a die press operator, and he was a factory worker at Ford between 1996 and 2002. He also was alcoholic. I believe he was a con artist and a sociopath.
I thought those were good descriptions you chose, or good words to describe him. Con artist, sociopath.
Yeah. And then his prior crimes included domestic violence against his family members, burglary, and theft. His victims were Patsy Cantrell, AJ Cantrell, Tyler Montgomery, Carla Wright, John Inman, who I didn't mention in the list earlier, because he was never prosecuted on that, Dr. Samuel Peebles and Martha Suzanne Peebles. Peebles. Sorry. All right. So the victims, these crimes occurred on October 18th, 2003. The victims were AJ, Patsy Cantrell, Tyler Montgomery, Carla Wright, and John Inman. So this is the backstory. In September of 2002, Eisenberg took a leave of absence from his job at Ford, left his wife and children in Michigan, and headed south. He showed up in Depew, Oklahoma, riding a bicycle and claiming it was a charity ride to raise money for victims of 9/11. John Wright was mowing the grass at the Methodist Church in Depew when Eisenberg asked permission to camp on the church grounds. Mr. Wright allowed Eisenberg to bunk inside the air conditioner church instead. Mr. Wright then went on to introduce Eisenberg to his family, including Carla, his wife, and his daughter and son-in-law, Kathy and Mark Biggs. He also invited Eisenberg to attend church with the Wrights and meet his neighbors, AJ Cantrell and his wife, Patsy. In addition to lying about his fundraising efforts, which I believe were a total lie, Eisenberg lied to the Wrights and Biggs families about who he was and why he was in Depew. After a brief return to Michigan, Eisenberg returned around Thanksgiving of 2002, claiming that his wife and children died in a car accident, which was a lie. They were alive and well. Eisenberg began an affair with Kathy Biggs and, with yet another lie about a multi-million-dollar lawsuit settlement, convinced her husband to move out of their house. In June 2003, Mark sought a protective order against Kathy and Eisenberg. Details of that are not available. As he had done with his wives, Eisenberg was abusive in his relationship with Kathy, and she eventually had enough and left him. In August 2003, she sought her own protective order against Eisenberg. In September, Eisenberg returned to their former apartment in Tulsa and ran up the cable bill watching porn. There is some information that he was also waiting for Kathy to come back to the apartment so he could kill her. When Kathy found out that he was in the apartment and running up the cable bill, she called police, who found him in the apartment and arrested him on charges of burglary, violation of a protective order, and malicious injury to property. While in jail, Eisenberg vowed to get even with Kathy. He told fellow inmates that Kathy was a pharmaceutical rep, another lie because she was a nurse, who was dealing drugs on the side. But Kathy was a traveling nurse, making that yet another lie told by Eisenberg. Got a little ahead of myself there. Sorry. On October 16, 2003, Eisenberg was released on bond and immediately made his way from Tulsa to Depew, where Kathy was living with her parents. He was so intent on his revenge against Kathy that he missed a court setting on October 17th, resulting in the day after he bails out, having a bench warrant issued for his arrest. On October 18, 2003, he arrived in Depew, Oklahoma, intent on his revenge against Kathy. He saw the Cantrells leave their home and broke into their house to enable himself to watch the Wrights' home across the street. He found a 410 shotgun, loaded it, and stocked his pockets with additional shells. When the Cantrells returned unexpectedly, Eisenberg held them hostage for hours while he waited for Kathy to return to her parents' house. Eisenberg claims that Patsy had convinced him to leave Kathy alone and that he only wanted to tell her that he would leave her alone. He claimed that when he put the shotgun down, AJ grabbed it and fired, fatally wounding Patsy and wounding Eisenberg's hand. That was when Eisenberg beat AJ to death with the shotgun. Once he'd killed Patsy and AJ, he went across the street to the Wrights. He walked into the house and immediately shot Kathy's 16-year-old son, Tyler, who was heading toward the kitchen. Tyler was hit in the back and briefly went down. While Eisenberg beat his grandmother, Carla, with a shotgun, Tyler had first tried to obtain a weapon, but they'd been moved probably to keep him out of Eisenberg's hands. He then went outside and got into his truck to get help. Eisenberg followed, jumping into the bed of the truck and shooting Tyler a second time through the back window. And Eisenberg was not the smartest tool in the shed because he shot Tyler while Tyler was moving. The truck was moving. Tyler was driving. And he aims at the back through the window and shoots Tyler at close range through the back window while the truck is in motion. That was damn stupid.
Well, Lisa, you're not considering that clearly. He has like Dr. Dorothy Otnow Lewis would say it's clearly has some kind of brain damage from all the abuse from his father. Yeah. And clearly you're not seeing the right victim here. You don't see the sarcasm in my voice dripping. I think that's what they would say, these killer apologists.
Well, to me, it proves how intent Eisenberg was on killing people.
Yeah, that's a great point. Good point.
You know, he shoots a kid driving a truck while the truck is moving and causes the kid to crash the truck, which results in Eisenberg being thrown, striking his head on the roof of the cab, and then being thrown out of the truck bed.
Yeah, I'm really surprised Hollywood hasn't done some kind of horror movie scene with this. I mean, he gets to the football. Have you gotten to the football field yet?
That's where the crash happened, at the football field. Yeah. I didn't use a lot of those details because they didn't, you know, I couldn't picture them.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this was.
Yeah, he lives onto the football field like Night of the Living Dead with all these bullets in his body. He somehow survives. I mean, wow, what an incredibly strong, you know, person to withstand that. And, you talk about these, just the victims, but everybody who witnessed him stumbling onto the field is now traumatized.
Yeah.
In some way, I can't say traumatized for life. I don't know how long they were traumatized, but some of them probably for life from that.
Yeah.
So it's like these crimes, they talk about this movement, you know, talks about the wrongful conviction movement, talks about this mistake that these killers made, this one mistake or five mistakes or 10 mistakes or however many mistakes they've made because of their own abuse. But they don't talk about how these crimes are really like ripples that go out into a lake and just reverberate the awfulness and the trauma just kind of ripples through the community.
Yeah, definitely. But John Inman, who was in the vicinity of the crash, picked up Eisenberg, who was bleeding from a gash on his head. Initially, Inman tried to convince Eisenberg to seek medical attention. When Inman demanded that Eisenberg unload the shotgun, Eisenberg initially refused, then got out of the car, pointed the shotgun at Inman's head. Thinking quickly, Inman grabbed the barrel and deflected it away from his head before Eisenberg could pull the trigger, which he did. So, yet another person that Eisenberg is intent on killing. And while his advocates would say he never intended to kill anyone, when you point a shotgun at someone's head, you're going to kill them if you pull the trigger.
And you're making a legal argument, you know, right there. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, you're really thinking like a lawyer there, which is he was perfectly okay with taking another life.
Yeah. As Ember managed to remain in hiding in Depew and evade capture in spite of a massive police search, he burglarized a home belonging to Rodney Lewis, where he stole clothing and a pistol that didn't fire because the firing pin was missing. He hid out in the Methodist Church food pantry, which I think was in an outbuilding, until November 23rd, 2003, when Doyle Petrie found the gun-wielding Eisenberg in the pantry. She ran screaming from the building, and Eisenberg stole her car. The car either ran out of gas or broke down in Waldron, Arkansas, where Eisenberg encountered Dr. Sam Peebles and his wife, Suzanne. Once they were on the road, Eisenberg brandished the broken handgun and took them hostage. During their captivity, Eisenberg made statements to the Peebles, which cast doubt on his claims about the death of Patsy and A.J. Cantrell. One of those statements occurred when Suzanne grabbed for Eisenberg's gun. Eisenberg threatened to shoot Dr. Peebles, then said that old man did the same thing and I killed his wife. There could be no doubt that Eisenberg intended to kill the Peebles as soon as they were no longer of use to him. Knowing this, Dr. Peebles took action in Texas, drawing his own gun and shooting Eisenberg multiple times. Eisenberg beat Dr. Peebles during a struggle, then placed the broken gun to Suzanne's head. When the gun failed to fire, Eisenberg hit her in the head and ran off. At a nearby convenience store, the clerk called police, and Eisenberg was taken to Lufkin, Texas, where he was eventually arrested. After being stabilized in a hospital, Eisenberg gave detailed statements in which he tried to minimize his own culpability for his crimes. Later, in a call to Kathy, he told her that his reign of terror was all her fault.
Well, come on.
Which,
let's be fair,
is the typical abusive.
Yeah, of course.
You know, that's the typical abusive.
Deny, attack, reverse victim offender.
Mm-hmm.
Right out of that playbook. Yeah, sure.
So, all right. So Eisenberg was arrested around December 8, 2003 in Lufkin, Angelina County, Texas, via a warrant out of Oklahoma. He was apparently also arrested and charged federally in Arkansas with kidnapping, which we'll talk about a little bit later as well. While he was still on the run on October 22nd, an information was filed charging him with assault and battery with a deadly weapon and shooting with intent to kill for his shooting of Tyler Montgomery. That information was amended on October 28, 2003, to add count one, murder in the first degree for Patsy, count two, murder in the first degree for AJ, count three, assault and battery with a deadly weapon, and count four, shooting with intent to kill. The venue in this case at the time was Honorable Joe Sam Vassar, the district court in and for Creek County, Bristow, Oklahoma, and it was under docket number CF-2003-00260. Eisenberg was represented by various attorneys from the Oklahoma Indigent Defense System, including Silas Lyman and L. Wayne Woodyard. There are a lot of attorneys listed on the docket sheets, but it's hard for me to decipher which ones were at which stage. So I elected not to list these attorneys at this time. He was arraigned on January 4th, 2004, and he either stood mute and a not guilty plea was entered for him, or he entered a not guilty plea. On April 6th, 2004, a second amended information was filed adding burglary in the first degree and burglary in the second degree for the entry into the Wright and Cantrell homes. And those were counts five and six. A bill of particulars was also filed in re punishment because the state was going to seek the death penalty for counts one and two, the first degree murders of AJ and Patsy Cantrell. Eisenberg's attorneys filed a waiver of speedy trial on April 7th, 2004. He was arraigned on the second amended information. He did stand mute at that arraignment on July 20th, 2004, and the judge entered a not guilty plea. On July 20th, Eisenberg filed a motion, an application for change of venue. And I think that that was probably warranted because Creek County, Depew, and Bristow are all very small towns. And everybody probably knows everybody. And so finding a fair and impartial jury in Creek County would have been difficult, if not impossible. The DA did respond on August 6, 2004, likely opposing it, but I actually think that it was a good move. And on September 7, 2004, the judge agreed with that and granted the change of venue to Canadian County to be tried during the February term. That means the same judge is going to hear the case. It doesn't, you know, go to a different judge or anything, because those counties are all in the same circuit.
So maybe a little bit more driving time for the judge, or maybe even a little less. It's all very close together. Is that what you're saying?
I think probably since they're in the circuit, the judges travel to those different counties anyway as a normal course of business. I don't think you still see the circuit system in a lot of states with a lot of small jurisdictions, small counties, small parishes, where, like in Louisiana, as an example, the 22nd, I'm trying to think of the court. Okay, let's see. The 18th Judicial District Court is West Baton Rouge Parish, Iberia Parish, or Iberville Parish, and one other parish. So the judges regularly travel from the different parishes because there are courthouses in each parish. And that looks like probably the same situation in Oklahoma. And it's the same in Arkansas. You remember Crittenden, Craighead. That's all the same judges.
Right.
And they just go from county to county during the different terms for each of the county courts.
Okay.
So the venue was going to remain with the Honorable Judge Vassar. It was going to be in and for the District Court of Canadian County, Oklahoma. The docket number was CF-2005-35, and trial on counts 1 through 6 were transferred there. Also on February 2nd, 2005, Linda Gay Cantrell was murdered by her boyfriend, Freddie Leroy Wheeler, who then took his own life. The couple had reconnected a few months before. They'd apparently gone to high school together and were living together in Edmond, Oklahoma at the time. Then to go over some of the other crimes that that Eisenberg has committed, and I count protective orders as crimes, even if he wasn't prosecuted for anything. There's the protective order on June 23rd, 2003, taken out by Mark Biggs against Kathy and Eisenberg, who were both served on June 23rd, 2003. There was a hearing on July 3rd, and the defendants failed to appear, so the final protective order issued. Then August 29th, 2003, Catherine Biggs took out a protective order against Eisenberg, who was served on September 2nd, 2003. Which I think was around the time he was arrested. No, I take that back. That wasn't when he was arrested. A final protective order was granted on September 12th, 2003. There was a hearing on September 16th at which Eisenberg did not appear, and the final protective order was entered on September 16th. On September 13th is when he was arrested for burglarizing the apartment in Tulsa. Then he has the attempted murder of John Inman on October 18th, the theft from Rodney Lewis's residence, which we don't know what date that was, the burglary of the Methodist Church food pantry on, we're not sure what date that was, and then the car theft on November 23rd, 2008. At trial, Eisenberg was represented by Oklahoma Indigent Defense System attorneys Craig Corgan, Charles T. Laughlin, and Janet Chesley. The state was represented by David Max Cook, the DA, Mike Loeffler, and Pamela Hammers. Jury selection was February 7th through February 10th. Then the guilt-innocence phase began on February 14th and ended on February 25th. The state presented their case and rested. The defense presented their case and rested, and jury were instructed. The verdict came down on February 25th, 2005. The jury found Eisenberg guilty of second-degree murder on count one as to Patsy Cantrell, first-degree murder as to count two on A.J. Cantrell, assault and battery with a dangerous weapon, count three, shooting with intent to kill of Tyler Montgomery, count four, first-degree burglary for the Wright residence, count five, and second-degree burglary for the Cantrell residence for count six. He was sentenced on the non-capital convictions to 150 years on count one, 10 years and a $10,000 fine on count three, life plus a $10,000 fine on count four, 20 years and a $10,000 fine on count five, 7 years and a $10,000 fine on count six. The penalty phase, phase two for count two, went ahead, and it's weird in the notes because it says the penalty phase was the 23rd through the 25th. So I don't know if they finished the guilt innocence phase and went ahead and called witnesses for the penalty phase, or how that happened. It's a little confusing within the notes on the docket, but that's what it says. On February 25th, the jury found two aggravating circumstances on count two: great risk of death to more than one person, and especially heinous, atrocious, or cruel, and sentenced Eisenberg to death. And the great risk of death to more than one person can be AJ and Patsy, and Tyler Montgomery, and Carla Wright, and John Inman. Not just AJ and Patsy. Because there were arguments that he didn't cause Patsy's death, so therefore he shouldn't be, you know, the great risk of death to more than one person is wrong or isn't proven. He was set for formal sentencing on March 24, 2005, at which time his judgments and sentences were issued. He filed a notice of intent to appeal to the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals on March 31st, 2005. Now, he was also charged in 2004 and indicted for two counts of kidnapping, carjacking by force and violence, use of a gun in a crime of violence, and theft of the Peebles 2003 Chevy van. He filed a motion in limine in that case to keep his statements to the Peebles out of that case on November 29th, 2005. The U.S. attorney responded on November 30th, and the court entered its order, sorry, my pages are sticking together, on December 1st, 2005, denying the motion in limine finding the statements sought to be admitted by the government are not prohibited by Rule 404B, as they are integral to the kidnapping charges against defendant, and their probative value is not outweighed by the prejudicial value. Evidence of Eisenberg's Oklahoma convictions may be admissible should the defendant elect to testify at trial, and the court will address this issue and the proper scope of cross-examination should defendant advise the court that he wishes to testify. He was tried from December 4th, 2005 to December 7th, 2005, convicted on December 7th, 2005. Sorry, sometimes I have the wrong dates. And he was found guilty of counts 1 and 2, kidnapping, possession, use, brandishing a firearm during a crime of violence, count 3, and armed carjacking, count 4. His judgment and sentence were entered on July 28, 2006. He was sentenced to 300 months to run consecutively. He was sentenced to 216 months on counts 1 and 2, 180 months on count 4, 4 months on count 3, 5 years supervised release, and a $17,500 fine. He filed a notice of appeal to the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals on August 4, 2006. And we're going to, because they were parallel at points, we're going to look at both the Oklahoma and the Arkansas proceedings in tandem to one another, rather than going through the whole Arkansas chronology and then going back to Oklahoma. So then we'll go back now to his direct appeal. Before the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals, he was represented by Leanne Jones Peters, Jamie D. Pybus, and the state was represented by Mike Edmondson, who was the AG at the time, and Seth Branham. The docket number was D-2005-319. The Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals rendered its decision on July 26, 2007. Defendant sought review of the decision of the District Court of Canadian County, Oklahoma, which convicted him of second-degree felony murder, first-degree malice murder, assault and battery with a dangerous weapon, shooting with intent to kill, first-degree burglary, and second-degree burglary. He was sentenced to multiple terms of imprisonment and to death for the first-degree malice murder count, and he further sought an evidentiary hearing. Defendant appealed his multiple convictions and death sentence, but the appellate court affirmed, stating that jury selection was proper. One juror stated unequivocally that he could consider all three punishment options and follow the law and instructions given to him by the court. His responses did not indicate an intention to disregard or circumvent the law of the trial court's instructions. Additionally, the failure of the trial court to advise the jury during voir dire that if convicted of murder, a defendant had to serve 85% of his sentence before being considered for parole did not result in a miscarriage of justice or constitute a substantial violation of a constitutional right requiring the judgment to be set aside. His death sentence was appropriate in part under Oklahoma 21701.122 because the evidence was sufficient to show that he knowingly created a great risk of death to two of the victims by holding them hostage at gunpoint. Additionally, the evidence showed that he was the worst of the worst and that the death penalty was appropriate. The judgment was affirmed in defendant's application for an evidentiary hearing on his Sixth Amendment claims dealing with jury selection were denied. There were judges concurred and dissented. The concurrences agreed with affirming Eisenberg's convictions, but they dissented regarding the death sentence on count 2, and they would have vacated that sentence and remanded for resentencing because the allegation was that two of the jurors on their questionnaires gave answers that led to the inference that they would only consider the death penalty for murder. Even though during voir dire, they each said, oh no, I will consider equally all three options, life, life without parole, and death.
Yeah, but after hearing what he did, they had their mind.
With A.J. Cantrell, mindset. I mean, this A.J. Cantrell was 70 years old. He was not in the best of health. Eisenberg was 42. And, you know, probably fairly, if not in, you know, 100% tip-top shape, was in fairly good shape. I mean, he had to have been fairly good shape to have lived over a month out in the wild without a roof over his head or, you know, food on the table. So after his direct appeal was, you know, his convictions and sentences were affirmed, he filed an extension of time with the U.S. Supreme Court, which was granted on the 20th of November, and he was given until February 1st, 2008 to file his writ. He filed his writ on January 29th, 2008. The state opposed on February 6th, 2008. Conference was held on March 14th, 2008, and the petition was denied on March 17th. 2008. So his conviction and sentences became final on March 17th, 2008. Kind of before part of this, at least while his direct appeal was going on May 21st, 2007, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals issued a corrected opinion affirming Eisenberg's kidnapping, firearm, use of firearm during a violent crime, and carjacking convictions in federal court. That opinion was very brief, and I elected not to pull from it with any information because the issues in the Arkansas case didn't have anything to do with the Oklahoma death penalty. He filed a request for rehearing, which was denied on June 29th. He filed a writ at the U.S. Supreme Court on September 27th. The U.S. waived its response. The case was conferenced on October 26, 2007. And on October 29th, 2007, his writ to the U.S. Supreme Court was denied. Then he went into state post-conviction. He was represented by Wendy Thomas Hobbs with OIDS and Amanda Vannerstall. Sorry if I pronounced your name wrong, Amanda. It's a difficult one. The state was represented by the Oklahoma AG and the Canadian Creek County DAs. That case was in the Court of Criminal Appeals, and it was given docket number PCD-2005-371. The Court of Criminal Appeals rendered its decision on August 20th, 2007. After carefully reviewing petitioner's application for post-conviction relief and his motion for evidentiary hearing and discovery request, we conclude, one, there exists no controverted, previously unresolved factual issues material to the legality of petitioner's confinement. Two, petitioner could have previously raised collaterally asserted grounds for review. Three, grounds for review which are properly presented have no merit. And four, the current post-conviction statutes warrant no relief, and I omitted those statutes. Accordingly, petitioner's application for post-conviction relief and application for evidentiary hearing and discovery are denied. The mandate is ordered issued upon the delivery and filing of this decision. So that is the Oklahoma post-conviction. And basically the issues he was raising were the same ones he raised in his direct appeal regarding jury selection. He added errors in a couple of other jurors, a couple of whom didn't even sit on his jury. So I don't quite understand where that was going. But most of the issues he raised in the post-conviction were direct appeal, just a new spin was added. Okay. So any thoughts or questions at this point?
No. Just a lot of litigation. And when you're a death penalty defendant, when that death penalty is on the line, you get a lot of, there's always a lot of appeals and a lot of really strong legal help involved.
Correct. And he was represented by different attorneys at trial and at direct appeal and on state post-conviction. And now we go into federal habeas and he's represented by yet new attorneys.
Yeah.
Whose names we've seen in other cases, Mark Henriksen and Randall T. Coyne. The state was represented by the Oklahoma AG, which are members of the AG's office, including Seth Branham, Caroline E.J. Hunt, and Tessa L. Henry. The venue was the U.S. District Court in the Western District of Oklahoma. The judge was the Honorable Robin J. Cothran. The case docket number was 5:08-CV-00377. The D stands for the initial filing was a different judge. But Judge Cothran is the one who made all the decisions and signed all the orders. So I put her name in. He filed a motion to appoint counsel on April 10th. The case was referred to Magistrate Judge Gary M. Purcell on April 11th. This is all in 2008. On the same date, Judge Randall Coyne was appointed. A case management conference was set for May 20th, 2008, 11 a.m., and procedures were set. Eisenberg's petition for writ of habeas corpus was filed on March 13th, 2009. So 11 months between appointment of counsel and it was 11 months before the petition was actually signed, which Oklahoma court is one of the few courts I actually see that in. In most other courts, it's you have to file the petition is the first thing you file, along with the motions to appoint and things like that. He had 13 grounds for relief. I elected not to enumerate them. Perhaps some other time I will, but if it comes up again. The state answered on July 2nd, 2009. Eisenberg filed a reply on September 2nd, 2009. On December 18th, 2013, which is 4 years later, more than 4 years later, the court entered a memorandum opinion. Petitioner has presented 13 grounds for relief. Respondent has responded to petition, and petitioner has replied. In addition to his petition, petitioner also filed a motion for evidentiary hearing, to which a response and reply have also been filed. The state court record has been provided. After a thorough review of the entire state court record, the pleadings filed herein, and the applicable law, the court finds that for the reasons set forth below, petitioner is not entitled to his requested relief. A judgment was entered denying relief, and an order was also entered on the same date granting a certificate of appealability on grounds 1, 2, 3, and 5. Eisenberg filed a notice of appeal on January 15, 2014 to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. After briefing on September 15, 2015, the Court of Appeal rendered its decision, holding that the record supported the district court's judgment in a habeas action filed pursuant to 28 U.S.C. Section 2254, that the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals correctly identified the rule that governed the question of whether a trial court that convicted defendant of murder and sentenced him to death erred when it denied defendant's motion to dismiss two jurors for cause and reasonably applied that rule in finding that the trial court did not commit legal error. The OCCA did not misconstrue or unreasonably misapply the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Simmons versus South Carolina when it found that the trial court properly instructed the jury that they did not have to impose the death penalty, but could sentence the defendant to life without parole. There was no merit to defendant's argument that he was denied effective assistance of counsel. The Court of Appeals affirmed the district court's judgment. Now, there were concurrences and dissents. Again, Judge McHugh and Judge Briscoe concurred in part. I join the majority's well-reasoned analysis in most respects and concur in its holding that Mr. Eisenber is not entitled to habeas relief. I write separately to note my disagreement with the majority's conclusion that the OCCA applied the correct legal standard in evaluating Mr. Eisenber's claim that juror DB was biased. And by biased, they mean that juror was basically committed to finding death over any other punishment. Judge Briscoe authored a dissent in part, which stated, I would affirm Eisenber's conviction, but reverse his death sentence and remand for resentencing before a fair and impartial jury. I agree with the majority that Eisenber has failed to establish his entitlement to federal habeas relief from his state court convictions. But contrary to the majority, I find merit to Eisenber's claim that he was denied an impartial jury and due process of law due to the trial court's denial of a for-cause challenge against juror DB, who served and voted to condemn Eisenber to death. Eisenber raised this issue on direct appeal, and the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals rejected it. As discussed below, I conclude that the OCCA's adjudication of this claim resulted in a decision that was contrary to or involved an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law as determined by the Supreme Court of the United States. I, in turn, conclude, applying a de novo standard of review, that the state trial court likewise failed to apply the proper legal standard in assessing whether juror DB could impartially consider the sentencing options available in a death penalty case. Juror DB should have been stricken for cause. As a result, I conclude that Eisenber has established his right to federal habeas relief on this claim in the form of a new sentencing proceeding. And for those of you who follow the Scott Peterson case, that's essentially what happened with Scott Peterson's death sentence. Was the California court, Supreme Court, found a flaw in the trial court's procedures to pick a jury. And although they found the convictions didn't need to be reversed, they reversed the death sentence.
Right. And that has nothing to do with the fact that California is very anti-death penalty and in its whole and is probably on its way out the door, the death penalty there, and that it's a very famous case. And
yeah. But I just thought to kind of like give people listeners are familiar with Eisenber to help with that reference. That was what Eisenber's attorneys were trying to do.
Yeah, absolute. I'm just saying that I'm not so sure about that claim of Scott Peterson's. Anyway, you know, a lot was made of it, out of it. But
no, a trial that long and that complicated.
That publicized. Was, yeah.
Yeah. All right. So Eisenber filed a motion for an application for extension of time at the U.S. Supreme Court, 15A-797. That was on February 4th, 2016. He was granted the extension of time, and his petition was due on April 11th, 2016. He filed this petition under docket number 15-8939 on April 11th, 2016. And that was, and I don't know how this happens, but he filed this in 2016, but it got a 2015 docket number.
Weird. Odd.
Unless, oh, you know what it is? It's because it's the 15 term. Even though it's chronologically in 2016.
Aha. Uh-huh.
That
There
year
you go.
number is the term of the court, not the year the claim was filed.
Okay.
Just so smart.
What do you mean the term of the court? What does that mean?
That means, you know, they sit October to June.
Oh, okay. That's what I thought you meant. I just, okay.
Yeah. So their term ends in June. They first Monday in October to, I think it's around the end of June. Don't quote me on that, but I think that's what it is. And that is like right now we're in the 2023 term. So cases filed will be 2023.
Got it.
And then after June, I think until October, they'll be 2023. Because you can still file things even though they're not sitting. You can file petitions and writs and things like that, and they handle them. Or they put them off and kick them down the curb, like they've done for Richard Glossop and Rodney Reed.
Oh, I mean, those are just, I mean, are they ever going to end? It just feels like it's, and I'm not even a victim's family member. I mean, they just go on and on and on and on and on and on.
I am hoping that they ultimately deny on the one that they've agreed to review, that they then dismiss the first one that's still pending, and then Oklahoma sets a date, and when they get another writ, which they inevitably will, that they deny it immediately. The problem
from
is you've got Sotomayor, Kagan,
right,
who are, you know, just looking for wrongful convictions, where, you know, seeing wrongful conviction everywhere they look, especially
awful judges
on death penalty case.
Yeah, awful, the worst. Yeah.
So, all right. So then we go back to the Arkansas proceedings. Oh, I'm sorry. The state filed its opposition in May. A conference was held in June, and on June 13th, 2016, the court denied Eisenberg's writ. And we go to the Arkansas proceedings. Eisenberg filed a motion to vacate on June 10th, 2016, seeking to strike count three, uses of firearm and a crime of violence. Now, this was as a result of a couple of cases that basically either found that the statute prescribing use of a firearm in a crime of violence was unreasonably vague, or, and this is really disgusting and horrible, and I'm not entirely sure how it happened, but it did, apparently did, or that kidnapping is no longer considered a crime of violence.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not. And I did not have time to go off on that tangent, but I have kept the case names and I have kept the information from the Arkansas proceedings. And at some point in time, I will go into that rabbit hole. But while I was doing the research for Eisenberg and trying to get ready for this show, I did not have the luxury of time to head down that rabbit hole. I just had to be disgusted by the potential that some jurist or jurists out there have decided that kidnapping is not a crime of violence.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So the U.S. filed an opposition on October 20th, 2016. The magistrate issued a report and recommendation on December 2nd, 2016, recommending that Eisenberg's motion be dismissed with prejudice and no COA issue. Eisenberg objected on December 13th. An order was entered on December 27th, 2016, adopting the report and recommendation in its entirety, denying Eisenberg's motion to vacate, dismissing the case with prejudice, and denying COA. Judgment was entered on the same day, basically carrying out that dismissal with prejudice and denying the motion to vacate. Notice of appeal was filed at the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals on February 23rd, 2017. On June 27th, 2017, the COA, the Court of Appeal denied the COA. Their mandate issued on August 21st, 2017. Eisenberg filed yet another writ at the U.S. Supreme Court, docket number 17-6117 on September 22nd, 2017. The United States filed a waiver of response on October 4th. A response was requested on October 17th, 2017. An order granting the U.S. needed an extension of time. They got it. They finally filed their response on December 18th, 2017. The case was conferenced on May 10th, 2018, and an order was entered on May 14th. The motion of petitioner for leave to proceed in form of pauperis, which just means without paying fees, and the petition for a writ of certiorari are granted. The judgment is vacated and the case is remanded to the United States Court of Appeals for the 8th Circuit for further consideration in light of Sessions versus DiMaia, and that's a U.S. Supreme Court case. Judgment was issued on June 15, 2018. The COA was granted on July 3rd, 2018 by the 8th Circuit. A judgment was entered on September 6, 2019. The joint motion for summary reversal was granted. Appellant's conviction on count 3 of the indictment was vacated, and the case was remanded to the district court for further proceedings. Eisenberg filed in the district court a motion to dismiss count 3 on September 16th, 2019. An opinion and order was entered on the 17th of September, vacating the conviction and sentence on count 3 by agreement of the parties in light of United States versus Davis. Following dismissal of count 3, resentencing of defendant will be necessary. So the motion to vacate was granted and count 3 of the indictment was dismissed. Eisenberg filed an unopposed motion to amend correct judgment on September 25th, 2019. The court amended the judgment on April 28, 2022. Eisenberg was resentenced to 300 months as to counts 1 and 2, 180 months as to count 4 to be served consecutively, 5 years supervised release on counts 1 and 2, and 3 years supervised release on count 4. Eisenberg apparently was not happy with that resentencing, and so he filed a notice of appeal on May 4th, 2022 at the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals. Briefing was completed. However, the 8th Circuit did not render an opinion. On July 1st, 2022, Eisenberg's execution date was set for January 12th, 2023. He was in phase one. He was one of the first six to be scheduled for execution after the U.S. District Court denied the challenge to Oklahoma's lethal injection proceedings. On the 20th of July, Eisenberg filed a motion for leave to file ex parte motion to approve proposed clemency budget and appoint an investigator under seal. On the 21st, the motion was referred to Magistrate Purcell, and counsel was ordered to submit a proposed budget. A motion for leave to file petitioner's ex parte motion to approve proposed clemency budget and to appoint investigator under seal was filed on the 22nd, along, I think, with the budget. An order was granting, was entered the 25th, granting the motion, filing the approved budget, and appointing an investigator under seal. On the 27th, an order granted the motion to approve proposed clemency budget. So the budget was filed on the 25th and then approved on the 27th. I Zimmer filed his clemency petition on November 18th, 2022. And basically, he cited to his birth mother's use of alcohol and drugs during her pregnancy with him and her suicide when he was 8 to 9 months old. He cites his father's alcoholism and resentment and abuse of Scott, and I think his sister. He cites the death of Dorothy in 1976. Dorothy was Stanley's second wife, who was a good stepmother to Scott and his sister. He claims that Kathy stole his money and that he was just trying to get it back so that he could leave Oklahoma. He claims he was breaking into the Cantrell's house to wait for Kathy, and that was just a bad decision. They downplay it because the Cantrells weren't there, and when Izember made entry through an open, and Izember made entry through an open or unlocked window. So, you know, like, if you don't lock your doors, then anybody can walk into your house if they want to.
Right.
And it's not really burglary. Because if you didn't want people in your house, you should have locked your door.
That's funny.
That kind of logic or lack thereof.
Well, my hippie parents growing up said, well, if they really want to burglar it, they'll find a way in. So we never locked our doors growing up, at least. Yeah.
The petition claims that Izember was unarmed when he went into the Cantrell's house and that he had no intention of interacting with them. It reiterates that the gun he used to hold them hostage was one he found in their house. It claims that AJ killed Patsy, and as he and Izember struggled over control of the weapon. Now he's changed his story, because he said they were struggling over the weapon, and he's also said that AJ grabbed the weapon and fired, and that's when he shot Patsy. What I believe happened is AJ tried to grab the weapon, never got control of it, and because AJ challenged him, Izember said, okay, I'm killing your wife, and killed your wife. And, you know, let's say this, too. If you are in a house and you have no intention of using a weapon, then when you find a weapon, you're going to leave it where it is. What Izember did is he found the weapon, which he probably went looking for, and then he loaded it and grabbed shells and put them in his pocket because he had to reload multiple times.
Right.
This was a shotgun. So, you know, he had to reload there. We know he had to reload when he was in the bed of the pickup truck. I believe right. He had to reload before he went in the Wright's house.
Exactly. And that's what got the people forget this, but that's also what got the Menendez brothers, is that mm-hmm. they went out to reload, which shows that they're not out of their mind. It's not that they're out of their mind with rage, is that they're in their right mind. They know what they're doing. They're thinking about the action that they're doing, and they have a motivation mm-hmm. and an aim to do something. So it's pretty damning stuff for him and his, what the defense team would call bad facts, right?
Yeah. Well, bad decisions. It's all just bad decisions.
Bad facts
quoting...
if you're defending him, you know what I mean? You don't want to, you try making up some excuses for that.
I'm now going to quote from this piece of work. Let's just call it that. Mr. Cantrell attempted to defend himself in his own home. The law affords him this right. However, it was clear from the situation that Scott was not there to harm them, and had they not engaged in self-defense, they would not have been harmed that day. This claim provides no basis in a jury trial for an affirmative claim of self-defense, but it should resonate with a clemency board as it indicates the unplanned and impulsive nature of the crime.
Right. He was just making music with his shotgun. He wanted the sound of the shotgun shells. He needed to make a rhythm section or something, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. He wasn't there to shoot anybody. He was just there, you know, to make music. hang out with some friends.
He was just hanging out to tell Kathy he was going to leave her alone.
That's right. He had to come back. It's just like Prince Andrew.
Yeah.
Had to come back and tell Epstein it was over in person and not take the chicken's way out, you know?
Yeah.
It wasn't, he was hanging out with a notorious child sex trafficker or whatever, pimp. It's just, he had to come back and live in his home and tell him it was all over. Got it.
So the clemency petition goes on to claim that Eisenberg entered a fight or flight mentality and went to get his escape money from Kathy Biggs, who, by the way, was not even there. Instead, he confronted her relatives and acted violently. He was injured, scared, and in absolute despair. He snapped. That is one of the most disgusting clemency petitions I've ever read in my life.
It sounds awful.
And I mean, Glossop's is, it comes very close to the puke factor of Glossop's.
That's hard to do.
But I mean, you know,
the life of being a defense lawyer, murderer, apologist. Yeah.
The sad part is that until Adam Luck left, that would have worked on his board.
How
he
so?
Was gone by the time Eisenberg came.
Mm-hmm.
But that would have worked on his board.
Oh, Adam Luck. Oh, yeah. All mm-hmm. that pardon parole board that gave
Kelly
almost
woman.
Everyone Julius Jones. Kelly,
yeah.
What was her name? Doyle. Kelly Doyle.
Doyle.
Where did I
yeah.
pull that? The former cheerleader. Oh, I mean, he thought it would be fun to sit on a pardon parole board and do the wrongful conviction movement's bidding. Both of them were activist people that got on the pardon parole board and were just giving pardons left and right. Mm-hmm. It was a serious problem in Oklahoma for a while. Oklahoma is one of these states where the movement has really gained hold and gotten to every sort of crack and seep and really made itself a fixture in Oklahoma, sadly. It's very immoral and very evil, in my opinion, the way they go about things.
Definitely.
It's almost like the criminals that they represent. They go about things almost in that way.
Definitely. And it's really sad that they're being aided by the media who disseminate their propaganda. But
exactly.
That's a topic for another day.
Sure is. Unless you want to hear us go on and on for hours, or me go on and on for hours and hours.
Because I don't think McDougal and Humphrey or the rest of the clown posse stepped in on Eisenberg.
No, I mean, he's so unlikable. I mean, just the pictures of him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if I say this, you know, there's always going to be someone in the audience to say, oh, that's so superficial. But I'm going to talk about his crazy eyes. His crazy eyes in the picture. He looks dangerous. And I know that shouldn't matter, but it does matter to the public. Mm-hmm. If you knew nothing about the case and you just look at that picture and say, would I be afraid of him? Yes. And that is why there's so much posturing and theater in these courts. It's because we do make judgments like that, mm-hmm. you know, whether they're fair or not. But he does have dangerous, scary eyes. And who wants to be the politician to get that guy off? I mean, I know they've gotten so many dangerous people off. I just posted a story on my Twitter account about the DA, one of these Soros DAs, Larry Krasner in Philly, lying to the court for a death row killer. And, mm-hmm. you know, we talk about them being the worst of the worst. Who would want to defend them? Well, the public doesn't know anything about the case, and the press will back them up and say it's great. Look at the way they're backing up the Innocence Project in Los Angeles on Scott Peterson. At first, they were all shocked, and now it's turning. Oh, are these claims have merit? They're really backing them up.
Well, hopefully that court decision on Krasner is going to come back to bite him on the ass.
Well, they want him to apologize. That's not to be disbarred. Apologize. That's the great punishment.
Yeah, but if he digs in and refuses, then
good point.
They hopefully will go further with the bar.
I hope so. Doesn't seem so. Like it. I have my email ready to write to the bar, certainly.
So the Eisenberg's clemency hearing was held December 7th, and he was denied 3-2. Then there was an administrative decision made by the Oklahoma Department of Corrections on January 4th, 2023, rejecting Eisenberg's request to have his spiritual advisor, Reverend Dr. Jeff Hood, in the execution chamber with him. Apparently, Hood's activism and perhaps some of the statements that he's been known to make in the media led the Oklahoma Department of Corrections to anticipate some difficulties from the good Reverend Dr. Hood.
Yeah. Can you talk about who he is for a second? Because he's a real creepy figure.
Yeah. I think, as I've called, because Eccles is emulating him, he's a Gandalf-looking motherfucker with the bald head and the long beard that looks like it hasn't seen shampoo or a comb or anything in
years.
He's
a creepy-looking guy along with Eccles, yeah. And his writing, he wrote the end about this kind of religious gobbledygook on the filing in the clemency packet. Just
yeah.
The same sort of, I guess, guilting yeah. the public. Where's your brotherly love? Where's your religion? Blah, blah, blah. Humanity. Where's the humanity in this low life creepo? That's where I get stuck with the death penalty, is when I really search myself deep down. Do I feel like there is any humanity? What humanity did mm-hmm. he show anyone? And I know I disappoint my family with this, but I just don't feel it. And I understand the Catholic position. I understand it, but
he's not. He's Baptist trained.
Good point.
And he's gone like to the old Catholic. He calls himself an old Catholic church. He's not. He hasn't gone to a legitimate Catholic seminary. It's like some internet Catholic seminary or internet ordination as a quote Catholic. You cannot be a Catholic and a Baptist. Those two are legitimately, among all the Protestant religions, I think that the Baptist is the farthest you can get from Catholic.
I would say Quaker is a little bit further.
No,
down,
because
but
Quaker,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Quaker is, no, Quaker is very, Quaker, I don't look at Quaker as even really a religion. It's a community.
May have a point.
And they follow probably Anabaptists. They're probably also like the Amish, an offshoot of I think it was Anabaptist is what it was called. An old order type. But I mean,
in
Baptist,
practice,
Southern
very,
Baptist.
Very
He's Southern Baptist.
Yeah, very, 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 very different. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's make
very
that
different.
Distinction
yeah.
too. Southern Baptist. But anyway, in my opinion, Episcopal is very close to Catholic because they have some of the same rituals, because the Anglican Church was never that far off Catholic. They got rid of some of the saints and they got rid of feast days, but they still cross themselves. They still have some of the same rituals and the same sacraments. Presbyterian, pretty far from Catholic. But very middle of the road. But Baptist is very, farthest. So to me, being a Baptist and a Catholic, they are mutually exclusive. And he does not know what he is.
Well,
and it's not
Eccles.
Religion,
He's a,
and it's not God. It's just him being, having all this platform.
Seems like a little bit like, yeah, Satanism, where they tell you you can be a Buddhist, you know, that follows all that, it has all that interest in Buddhism while supporting their own God. I mean, it's really like your own God. I mean, it really follows that kind of satanic logic.
So, and you know, like Eccles, he wears long sleeves and these long pants that look like a full diaper. It's just creepy. Yeah, the creepy is a good word for it.
I would say the clothes are the least of his issues. It's his creepy hanging out with killers and putting them forth as upstanding human beings.
Yeah.
You know, child killers, regular old, you know, white women beaters, killers, you know, talking about their humanity. I mean, please.
So on January 10th, 2023, Eisenberg and Hood filed a complaint against the DOC, challenging their decision to deny Hood access to the execution chamber on January 12, 2023. They also filed an application for temporary and permanent injunction, which would bar Eisenberg's execution until Hood was allowed access into the execution chamber. On the same date, the 10th, a joint notice of settlement was filed on behalf of all parties, and a notice of voluntary dismissal was filed on the 11th of January, withdrawing the action with the consent of the defendants. Eisenberg's execution went forward on January 12, 2023. The drugs were first administered at 10:02 a.m., and Eisenberg was declared dead at 10:15 a.m. The death warrant was filed by the Oklahoma Department of Corrections on January 18, 2023. In the Arkansas proceedings, because the Eighth Circuit had not rendered a decision on that appeal of Eisenberg's sentencing, which I also did not go down that rabbit hole, but would be interested at some point to do, a suggestion of death was filed on January 17, 2023 by the Federal Public Defender's Office, noting that Eisenberg had been executed on the 12th. Judgment was entered on January 18, 2023, directing the clerk of court to administratively close the appeal and issue the court's mandate. And on the 24th, the case was administratively terminated by mandate. Now, story's not over, because on March 24, 2023, Jeff Hood filed a complaint against the Oklahoma Department of Corrections and one of its officials, Mr. Ward, in the United States District Court for the Western District of Oklahoma. It was assigned docket number 523-CV-00265-J. The first flaw in that plan was that he hired a Texas attorney who was not authorized to practice law in Oklahoma, and who apparently didn't think that she had to do what the Oklahoma courts told her to do as a result of that. The causes of action filed were defamation per se, conspiracy, violation of First Amendment rights, and violation of due process rights. Hood was seeking actual damages, pain and suffering and mental anguish suffered by plaintiff, loss of quality of life, exemplary and punitive damages, as well as reasonable attorney's fees and costs of court, reasonable attorney's fees for the preparation and trial of this cause of action or its appeal, pre-judgment interest, and post-judgment interest. Now, basically, the reasons cited by the DOC to deny Hood access are what he was complaining about.
Okay.
So, you know, that they lied about how many times he was arrested and why he was arrested. And they lied about him disrupting the execution or potentially disrupting the execution. I'll send you the complaint. It's an interesting little read. Okay. On the 28th of March, the court ordered Hood's counsel to associate local counsel who was would then be required to enter an appearance by April 4th, 2023. On April 5th, 2023, when that didn't happen, his counsel was again ordered to show cause on April 12th, 2023, why she did not comply with the March 28th order. On the 20th of April, 2023, Hood's counsel had failed to comply with the court's orders or to communicate with the court, so the case was dismissed without prejudice, meaning it was dismissed, but Hood could get it refiled under with another attorney. On May 4th, 2023, Coles, Hood's counsel, did file an entry of appearance, but the court was tired of her shit. And so an order was immediately entered on May 4th, striking her entry of appearance as counsel for Hood. And basically saying she's not counsel for Hood. On August 22nd, 2023, even though the case was dismissed without prejudice, the Oklahoma Department of Corrections and Ward filed a 12B6 motion to dismiss, citing their immunity under the 10th and 11th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution, dealing with sovereign immunity. An order was entered September 13, 2023, granting the motion to dismiss and dismissing the case with prejudice. A judgment was entered the same date, dismissing the case with prejudice. And as far as I can tell, a notice of appeal was never filed. So that is a final decision. And Hood's attempt to get paid by the Oklahoma Department of Corrections has failed miserably.
I like to hear that.
So, Hood is a creepy little man. He was advocating for Anthony Sanchez as well. There's a lot of reasons I don't like him.
Yeah, there's no one too dangerous and deranged that these people won't say that they're wonderful and try to stop mm-hmm. justice from being.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's justice, whatever their sentence is from being seen through.
I agree. I totally think that the death penalty does provide a measure of justice to society and to the families of survivors of murder victims.
Yeah. Did you listen to the statements given by the victims' family members? Were really
yes,
interesting
I
in
did.
This case.
I did.
Yeah, I encourage people to check them out. They're just like, we don't know if this is closure, because they don't ever get closure. They have a life sentence of grief. They're really sentenced to these victims' families, but they say this is the closest it comes. You could almost just hear in their statements just a sigh of relief that mm-hmm. that something was over, that this battle yeah. was over. It was done.
I think we
always see these victims' family members that oppose the death penalty really put forth by our media, and you don't often see these kind of statements made. Really grateful and thankful to the process, and a kind of peace. And that's all I can describe mm-hmm. it as, a sigh.
Yeah.
As a calm and a sigh and deep with deep sadness.
I think what was it? One of the, I think a nephew of the Cantrell said, our enemy is now dead after 20 years.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, no, closure is different for different people. For some people, closure is not having to worry about the sentence being commuted and then the person being released to victimize more people.
Yeah.
And because that was Bethany's mother's experience with Stephen Wood. Or Woods, whatever his freaking name was. that she knew he would never talk his way out of prison because he was dead.
Right. And our media goes into these prisons, and, you know, Julius Jones, when his death penalty sentence was commuted, he was making $30,000 a month out of prison selling sneakers and stuff. I mean, there's all sorts of ways that they go on to victimize other people, even within prison when it's commuted mm-hmm. to life, by giving interviews, by re-blaming the family, by having these innocence campaigns go on and on and on, by selling their story, you know, selling their story. We don't have mm-hmm. any kind of Son of Sam laws, at, you know, the way we used to. So they can make as much money as they want in there and keep blaming other people, terrorizing other people. Oh, in Julius Jones' case, threatening witnesses to change their story and mm-hmm. all sorts of crazy stuff.
Yeah. And social media has made it worse.
For sure. For sure. There's got to, I think there's, has to be some kind of, you know, I'm talking about the Karen Reed case, and it's gotten to a dangerous level where the head of the campaign has been charged with witness tampering, but mm-hmm. people are going door to door accusing random people who are witnesses in the case and who would want to be a witness in any case. Mm-hmm. Every time I'm on court TV chat or whatever, law and crime chat on a live trial, every witness that gets up there is roasted for their looks and their statements and the way they move their hands. Or their, I mean, who would want right. to be any kind of witness? They did nothing wrong except they were in the wrong place at the wrong time and happened to be some part of a crime, either directly or indirectly.
And well, what's even worse is that they're, you know, they are targeted for the position or the side that they're on. In other words, if there are pro-defendant people, the witnesses for the state are being targeted. Yeah, if they're pro-victim sure. prosecution, then the witnesses for the defense are being targeted. Because of what they're saying, mm-hmm. you know, that should be able to play out. I don't think that court TV should have the chat threads or the social media. Yes, show us the proceedings, but mm-hmm. leave the court of public opinion and all of its inherent bullshit out of it.
Well, yeah, it's also very manipulated, as we saw with the Johnny Depp thing. And, you know, new stuff is coming out about that and all these paid for bots, pro Depp bots, and all sorts of things that happen because people are tribe animals and they want to be part of the herd. So when there's, you know, when there's a lot of people saying one thing, you think, oh, am I crazy? Should I think this, that, and the other? Or you want to be part of it? It's odd. Yeah. It's an odd thing.
So
anyway,
well, I think
Lisa,
we've talked about it. People get invested in their opinion and they refuse to see the alternative thing. I mean, they think if somebody can explain why they did something, even though the explanation is totally illogical and unreasonable and doesn't make a damn bit of sense. Like, well, I was just waiting to tell her I was going to leave her alone. Mm-hmm. Well, then you leave and you never darken her doorstep again. That's how she knows you're leaving her alone. That's the very definition of leaving her alone.
Exactly.
But if he says that, then that means he didn't mean to do anything bad. He wasn't right. doing anything bad. It's okay for him to go to the neighbor's house because their doors weren't locked.
Right.
Or their windows were open.
Right. And it also, it's like, you know, we don't really understand how stalking really is a crime of violence or a prelude to violence and it's, you know, act of violence mm-hmm. in itself. I don't think that the public really understands that if someone's stalking you, that is, you're in a dangerous situation. And that it is a kind of a form of violence in itself that can escalate to physical violence. That's the next, you know, just mm-hmm. that's where it's headed.
Yeah.
So
definitely. All right. Well, I think that is on that wise note.
Okay. Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you so much. Again, Roberta, I can't thank you enough for sitting in for Kyle today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Lisa. Have a great one.
Have a great night. Thanks.
All right. See ya.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Based in Fact, a true crime podcast with Lisa O'Brien and guest co-host Roberta Glass. If you like the show and want to know more, you can subscribe to our YouTube channel, find us on Facebook, or follow me on Twitter at O'Brien L. Ann. Kyle and I will return in 3 weeks for episode 5, State of New Jersey versus Melanie McGuire. Between May 5th and May 16th, 2004, 3 suitcases containing dismembered human remains washed up near the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel. The remains were found to be those of Bill McGuire, a New Jersey computer program analyst. In 2007, his wife Melanie was convicted of Bill's murder and sentenced to life in prison plus 5 years. We'll talk about Bill's disappearance, their troubled marriage, and the evidence against McGuire, along with the course of direct appeal and post-conviction claims since her 2007 conviction. Until then, have a great 3 weeks and stay safe. Thank you.